Welcome to Theology on Tuesdays, everybody. I'm so glad that you're here. Thanks for coming out on this rainy afternoon. I'm so glad it didn't flood, and I'm so glad to see all of you. I want to introduce you to, obviously this is not Brian McGreevy, this is my friend Pete Dickinson. He's going to join us this evening for one of my favorite things that we do every few months, which is Double Jeopardy, fishbowl kind of thing. All the questions that we haven't gotten to that you've submitted over the last few months, I've gone ahead and put into this lovely cookie jar, I guess. And so now we get to put our hands in the cookie jar tonight and not get punished. It's going to be great. We're so glad that you're here. You'll see these little sheets of paper scattered around the room. These are really important. You can join our email list by scanning that bottom left QR code, and you'll be regularly, that's every week or two, that we'll send out an email of just updates and that sort of thing. Normally we're every other Tuesday, but because of Debbie and other cancellations from over the summer with rain, we're going back to back. So we're going to meet tonight, and we're going to be back next Tuesday as well. Normally we're over in the whiskey room, but we're just delighted to be wherever the folks at Henry's allow us to be. And we've got a number of things starting up. So I should say, Pete, you're the dean and rector at the cathedral downtown, and I am the assistant for young adults and family ministry at St. Philip's. And so we have one of the things I'm super excited about, and what I wanted to do was get more folks, because Brian and I both are at St. Philip's, so we wanted to get more folks from around the community when Brian was away. So we've got Pete joining us tonight, which I'm thankful for you coming out. Next Tuesday, we've got a good friend of mine, Jason Hamshaw from Florence, who's coming down, who's going to join me as well. So if you're interested, I know this case is probably true at the cathedral, but we've got a number of different Bible studies that are going to be launching up here in the next couple weeks as the semesters begin. And if you're looking to get more involved in the fellowship, you know, this is every other week typically, but outside of that, we have this thing called Holy City Life, which is usually on the off weeks. That will be a time where folks will get together and do some fellowship. So Alexandra, I saw her earlier. I don't know, there she is. Hey, and Meredith, there she is. Awesome. They both kind of coordinate that and head that up. So talk to them. You can sign up for that group me and just kind of be in the know for all things Holy City Life. So I think Brian sends his regards, but you want to take a guess as to where he is right now?
I know.
Italy. You know where he is. Did somebody say Italy? Not Italy, but he's making his special annual pilgrimage in the footsteps of C.S. Lewis to Oxford. So that's where he is in England, and he'll be there for a couple weeks and come back. But let's go ahead and jump in, and then what you can do, you'll see the top QR code at any point tonight. So we'll get through maybe 20, 25 minutes of doing this, and then we'll throw it open to any questions you have whatsoever. You can ask anything, and we'll do our best to answer. But the goal, Pete, here is to try to rapid fire, you know, keep it within a minute, which Brian and I never seem to be able to do. I don't know how. But we always start out with a hefty number of questions, and we maybe just scratch the surface on how many we get to. But we'll see. The goal is to try to get through as many as we can.
Cool.
And we'll just take turns rotating, and I will go ahead and start us off. But feel free to chime in as well. All right, and this is actually, if heaven is a if heaven is a monarchy and not a republic, why shouldn't we have a monarchy here on earth? Shouldn't government on earth, assuming, model that of heaven?
Ooh.
How about that? That's an interesting question. There are a couple things that my mind goes to that I'll start with. So I think that while we are striving for heaven, there are a number of things that make that impossible here on earth. But specifically with this question, the monarch of the kingdom of God is God himself. So there's a huge distinction when you have God, but then created individuals who, because of sin, are not perfect. And so that doesn't mean that monarchs are sinful, you shouldn't have a monarchy form of government. But I think one of the things that we'll see is that this is not prescribed in the Bible, that there's a number of different approaches to how people can be ruled in the world. Monarchy is a valid one, but there is also, what we have, a constitutional republic, that sort of thing. So any thoughts that you have about that?
I think it's just, as Christians, we've always recognized that our role in society is one of ambassadors of a different government, which is what you were saying, the kingdom. And so whether we get dropped, and I've lived in England and lived in the midst of a constitutional monarchy, and I've lived here for the majority of my life, and I've visited China, and I've visited Russia in adopting my children, and wherever I was in any of those different kinds of forms of government, and they're all fraught with some potential for corruption or problematic because of, you know, it's an attempt at trying to bring order in the midst of a fallen world. But always the role of the Christian is to be ambassadors, to be Christ's ambassadors in the midst of it. And so to be subjects of the kingdom who are also present and, yes, citizens of whatever government you happen to be under and whatever country you're a citizen of, for sure. And you can have pride in that, and you can be very patriotic and be courageous and lay down your life for that nation and believe it's a better form than that form, but it can't trump the other. And I did not say that ironically. I just said that with the real original version of the meaning of the word. But you see what I'm saying, is understanding ourselves in that role. So, I think that's just making sure that we don't think that... anyway, I'm not being pithy. Sorry.
Done. No, that's good. No.
Actually, what was the question? Shouldn't it? I should have just said no.
I should have said, yeah, exactly. Yeah, we could have said... Brian's been known to do that every so often. I think he's, but I'm sympathetic to the question because I try to take all the questions that we get, even though they may be tongue in cheek, to as sincerely as I can. And I trying to, as you're saying, being ambassadors of the kingdom of God, we want to see more of God's rule and reign on the earth. But we have to recognize until he actually returns, which he promises to do, that's going to be imperfect. And so any human being that's not the God-man Jesus Christ is not going to resemble what the monarchy of heaven is going to be like. So you have to manage that. Why don't you grab one?
Okay. All right.
Here we go. I got
what
a flash
devotionals there. Do you recommend? You want to go first?
Sure. There are a number of them. I like a lot of dead people and to read, and that's really kind of lame, I guess, but I'm partial to Spurgeon's Morning and Evening. I like that. I do like, you know, every so often I read a lot of the Bible, and I find it's helpful to have a very accessible commentary to go with that. So I find the Bible Speaks Today series to be kind of a nice companion as I'm doing devotions. Admittedly, a lot of my devotions are just from reading the scripture, but I did like, there's some good ones. I know if Brian were here, he'd say like Lewis in a year, there's like those books that will compile either Lewis's Reflections on the Psalms or something like that. How about you? What ones come to mind for you?
A couple. I mean, mine was for his highest, Oswald Chambers, great classic one that's really good. And then there was one that Lloyd Ogilvie did, which was, again, sort of 365 different little devotionals worth a bit of things. There's one, a companion to the Psalms by Eugene Peterson, Praying the Psalms, I think it's called, maybe, something like that. So that's excellent. I have to confess, like, recently I haven't really been using devotionals. I've just been doing the daily office, and I think as Anglicans, that's kind of our go-to move is to pray the daily office, and sometimes I find there are seasons when I really want guidance from another voice, i.e. a devotional with somebody kind of giving their take on whatever passage, and then there's other seasons when, you know what, I really just need the word to speak to me, and I just need to sit with it, and then, you know, whether it's right or whatever, trust the Spirit of God to be your devotional partner. And journal whatever comes to mind as you read the scriptures. It is helpful to have some sort of way of organizing what you're reading in the scriptures, and that's where the daily office comes into play.
I like that a lot. And there's been times where I've felt like in reading the Bible, just going through massive chunks, and then there's been times where it's just nice little itty-bitty things. But I think we've mentioned this before, but Lectio Divina has been a tool that, for me personally, it's a way of reading the Bible, And it, especially in seasons of my life when reading the Bible was hard or dry, I would go to that, and especially the Psalms is a place that I like to go. But you can do it in any part of the Bible. And essentially what you're doing is you're intentionally, you're reading the same passage, and if it's anywhere from, you know, a couple of verses to like 15 verses, reading it and trying to read it slower and slower each time. But the first time you ask a question, okay, just trying to wrap your mind around what is the passage saying, and then the second time you're intentionally inviting the Lord, what are you trying to say to me in this? And you read it between each one of those times, and then the third time you're reading it and saying, Lord, what do you want to say to me today, and why are you saying this to me today? I think is that third question. So second, what does this mean? Third one, why are you bringing this up to me today? And then finally resting in that the fourth time you read it. And I found just the discipline of asking those basic questions and not getting, I'm somebody who's very analytical and I like to just do all the studying and all of that. And sometimes it's really helpful just to, as you said, listen to what God is speaking in his word. And it's a discipline to just slow down, especially doing that. So.
Yeah.
Anything else you want to add to that?
No, I didn't actually get to say hello. I'm glad to see you. I'm really happy to be here, and it's really a treat. And so thank you for the invitation, Justin. And I'm a big fan of this guy.
Oh, my goodness. Okay, yeah, I'm a terrible host. I have not actually, like...
I am the dean of the cathedral.
I knew he's the dean. I was like, he's...
That's all you need to know.
He's a big deal. But how we...
Which cathedral?
How we knew each other. The cathedral. Thank your cathedral.
You. Thank you.
Your cathedral. Pete, I grew up at St. Michael's Church, and you happened to be there for a little while I was a wee lad.
I was there for 6.5 years.
Yeah.
That's more than a little while. I threw some serious time in. I put my time in.
It all blurred together for me.
And you know what? That was. I was there for 6.5 years. This is the first time I've ever set foot in this building, and then we went and got those pizzas, those ginormous pizzas at this place. I didn't realize that there was parts of Charleston I had never even... Yeah, anyway, it's cool to be here.
Stick with me.
Anyway,
I'll show you
glad
places.
Glad to be here. Thanks for having me. Thanks for having me. That's okay.
Sorry. I apologize for how disordered
this is. I do remember
this
man when he was an adolescent and went off to Duke to play golf.
That's right. That is... Yes. All right. Moving on. How do you handle setting boundaries with people who you know are not good to have in your close proximity without seeming completely dismissive?
Wow.
My first thought is if you feel like you need to set a boundary, chances with certain people that you know are not good for you to be in close proximity with, the danger, I think, is being too soft in applying that. And so I would encourage you, if you're going to err and you know that, like, all right, I need to, you don't want to be totally rude, you don't want to be dismissive, but if you know the Lord is calling you to put, because this person, for whatever reason, is not a healthy person for you to be in close proximity with, don't go halfway. And I think if you're going to err on one side, I'd err on the side of trying to follow what you think the Lord's calling you to do. I always find... prayer, right? But like, if it is appropriate, it's hard to answer this in the abstract, but like, if it's appropriate to talk to this person as you're going to do a boundary, I can see situations where it would be, I can see maybe where it wouldn't be appropriate to even mention that, but just being honest about like, hey, this is what I think I'm going to devote my time to, couching it positively of like, this is where I think I need to go, and what I'm going to do, and going back to the question of if you setting boundaries with people who you know are not good to have in your close proximity without being dismissive. You can just say that. I think if you're ever afraid of coming across a certain way, you can have the freedom to say, I don't want you to interpret me this way. And that doesn't mean they won't do that, right? But I think it's never a bad idea to err on the side of just being truthful of what you hope this is not going to be interpreted as. But going back to what I said originally, I think leaning into, if you know this is not what the Lord wants you to do, to not go halfway in that. What would you say?
Well, obviously that question, I don't know who asked it originally and what the circumstances were. And there's different kinds of versions of this. And there's sometimes when it's about safety, and people that are, you know, dangerous to be around for one reason or another. And then there's other ones where it's more kind of stewardship of time. And then there's ones, and the thing that kind of immediately came to mind is, you know, I've been a rector of a church for 15 years, and so in that time there's been people on staff that have needed to be terminated from their position. And that's always a really hard thing, because you think, oh gosh, this is a really unloving thing to do. And I read a book called Necessary Endings by Townsend and Cloud and Townsend, those guys. And I thought it was a really helpful book. And what it boiled down to, and I think this is probably a good litmus test for any of these kinds of, whether it's breaking up with someone that you've been dating, or it's setting a boundary in terms of somebody that's unhealthy, or if it's just making a good choice in terms of use of your time, is what is the motivational purpose in it? And until that is somehow rooted in a form of love, like ultimately, really what this is about is love. And in some ways, by setting this boundary, I'm actually helping this person understand their actions have consequences. Or maybe it's, in the case of firing someone, you know, this isn't a good fit for them in terms of their vocation, and they know it, and you know it, and sentimentality is just long-term cruelty, so like, get on with it. But I can remember any kinds of those kinds of tough conversations, I have to sort of sit with it for a while, pray, and when I kind of get this sense of like, okay, yeah, my motivation in this is not self-centered, and just making my life easier, it's actually loving towards the other, then I'm really safe to sort of say pretty hard things, just like Jesus did on plenty of occasions. He said some pretty hard things, you know, rebuking his best buddy, Peter, you know, get behind me, Satan, like, that's, he did that out of love for Peter, but for those around him and for the church long term. So, anyway, those are my thoughts.
Yeah, that I think that was the examples that, the way I took that question of, like, firing somebody or being in a relationship, like dating, that you know, sometimes I think our tendency is to probably just kick the can down the road and not be honest. And if it's like pulling off the Band-Aid, it's just better to do that. But I'm glad you brought in the other examples too. It's a hard question to answer in the abstract.
Yeah.
So you want to go to the next one?
Sure. How should we approach fellow Christians who get caught up in rapture hysteria? This recently happened with yesterday's eclipse.
So that was not yesterday.
Really?
It was last week. It was Debbie, I guess. That was the thing.
Wow. Was there really rapture hysteria with that eclipse?
Apparently. I think.
Who here has actually had encounters with rapture hysteria? Or who here has come home thinking that your family was going to be there and then they weren't and you thought you missed the rapture?
A couple.
Okay. I mean, I want to make sure we use up our time a little. I don't know. Is it rapture hysteria? Well, are we talking about, like, how do you take it? Is it premillennial, postmillennial, blah, 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 blah?
No, I don't think we need to go that far into it.
I recommend reading as many of those books by LaHaye and what was that series of books that
Left
was
behind.
So
hard.
Left Behind.
Left Behind. That'll answer all your questions around this. It's
oh,
really
Pete.
Solid
No, don't do that. All right. No. So, I would say, very briefly, because y'all know what the rapture refers to, assuming? So, it's like this understanding, and some Christians hold that Jesus is going to come back, rapture the Christians, and
the real Christians,
leave,
just so you know.
And leave behind everybody else for a season on earth. That's a particular view of the end times, and I think when it comes to rapture hysteria, all of this is about, it revolves around, is Jesus coming back? And now what I want to say is, yes, he promised he is. But he also said, and really importantly, you're not going to know the day or the hour. So I think keeping both of those two things in mind is sufficient answer without going into everything else. But why don't you, since
Sorry.
That was like a half a question.
I was being too sarcastic.
Yeah.
Sorry about that.
It's all good.
But it is... All about that. Okay, how can we look well-kempt, adhere to dress codes while considering the feelings of others who may be more informally dressed?
I feel like I need
Should
to...
Should we match others' formality?
So, we did a theology on tap.
Personal, can I just say this? The first thing I uttered to this guy as I walked in and saw him show up in a collar and I was wearing my regular duds, I said, I'm underdressed. the first thing I said to you tonight.
Yeah, yeah. And so, I don't think I said, I'm deeply offended at that. So it's okay.
I didn't say I'm unkempt.
So we did a whole one of these on a theology of apparel, which was fascinating.
Okay. I think it's an interesting question, yeah.
So, yeah, any thoughts?
Do we dress for ourselves or do we dress for others?
That's good.
I remember having this conversation with one of my kids and even talking about, again, what is your ethic? Is it rooted in vanity? Or is it rooted in love? You know, people always ask clergy, like, what are your views about vestments? And when I lived in England, I was at a seminary that was very kind of anti-high church, and I came in as this American, and they were like always obsessing about vestments and whether you should wear these or not. Is it, you know, there was this really great guy named Peter Sandlin who was from Northern Ireland and very orange, if you know what that means, like very Protestant. And he was like seeing these guys, he's like, oh, the Pope is the Antichrist, and you know, you wear vestments, it's a bunch of idolaters, you know.
That's pretty good.
Anyway, and I used to always say, well, listen, what are we doing? I said, we match and we meet people where they are. We dress. If I'm in Tonga, I'm going to wear a skirt.
Yeah.
Because that's what men do there. And if I'm here, I'm going to, you know, dress accordingly. And so I think in that sense, again, you know, dressing well for the sake of, like, I always want to say, how do we get our motivation rooted in the love of other, love of neighbor. And I think fashion and what we wear can actually fit into that ethic just as much as anything else we do.
Yeah, I think I echo some of that and say part of the principle is, you know, fashion trends change, they ebb and flow, and they'll be totally different in different parts of the world. I think of the verse where Paul says, I'll become like anyone if it means to preach the gospel. And becoming all things to all people in that sense. And I think fashion certainly falls under that verse as what would be appropriate. I do think that there is a sense of, in each culture, what is actually a sign of honor and respect. And so you're talking about dressing for others. The motivation, I think, should be we want to not draw attention to how much money we have. I mean, there's all sorts of rebukes in the New Testament about, you know, people in the church doing that. But to wear nice clothing as a sign of I'm going to honor those in the presence of whom I'm coming. And I do think that there's a sense in which if you showed up in a tuxedo tonight, that would be a little bizarre and probably more inappropriate. And I appreciated some of the questions that were like, so does this mean that we're all going to get really dressed up the next Theology on Tuesdays that we're after doing this? And it's like, not necessarily, because this is a relaxed environment. But if you showed up to like Christmas Eve dinner at like grandma's house and everybody's like, there's a sign of like, oh, I might want to put on like a dress shirt or something like that. And so the motive, as you said, I think is to love and to honor and respect.
And I will say there's a generational shift, and there's even regional shifts in terms of these things. And so, you know, this one is one of those sort of mushy ones that kind of moves and you kind of have to watch. But I think, again, what's motivating you in what you're doing and why you're doing it and for whom you're doing it.
So. All right. We are not, I mean, like, I was way more optimistic, again, this time.
All right, shorter answers. Come on.
Okay.
Go.
All right. How do you...
Good shot at that with two clergy.
How do you respond to people who claim... I don't know if that's right, who claim porn is victimless, especially when it comes to crossing into truly disgusting material?
I mean, they're wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, obviously, you know.
There's a number of...
The victims, that those involved, and most times there is some story of real brokenness that leads to participating in that trade, but also the way it entraps so many young people, early age... I think that's pretty easy to.
Yeah, there's a number of. There's been a number
of. There's plenty of victims
things.
Involved.
Yeah, and so I think there's plenty of victims, right? Like you're saying.
And if you disagree with that, I'm happy to have a conversation afterwards.
All right, we did one on summer reading. So tips for making more time for reading.
Wrong guy to ask.
I don't think there's like a secret. You just do it. Like at the end of the day, like
read good books. That's one thing.
Yeah, read something you'll want to do.
Shut ones that aren't going well. Like don't like. I used to really be obsessed with like if I start a book, I gotta finish it. If it's not working, just quit.
There's yeah.
A lot of books out there. So just read stuff that you're really jonesing on.
I think anytime you take an audit of your life, you'll find there's plenty of time that you're waiting. And even if you're doing like, I mean, there's apps that are like, you have a 5 minute a day goal of reading or something like that. Like if you just devote like 20 minutes, you can read a lot.
Yeah. All right. Do you believe that the Big Bang happened, but God created it that way? None of your damn business. Governor Walz. I wasn't there. I definitely think God created the universe, the cosmos. I think that's fair to say. How he did it, whether it was the Big Bang or whatever, you know. Why not? You know, maybe not. Who cares? Ultimately, I think it's fascinating to learn about God's creation, and I think so. Science and biology, and maybe the evolutionary biology, is an interesting field to look at. As long as it doesn't steer you away from this notion that there is a prevenient being, there is one who was before all things and out of nothing created everything. The rest of it, I think, is until we get face to face with him, I don't know that we're gonna know.
Yeah.
A lot of mystery there.
What was life-changing for me, because this was something that I wasn't like super into the science or whatever, but when the moment, I think it was in high school, I started reading something and realized Christians have found, there's at least like 5 or 6 major different ways to interpret Genesis 1 and 2. And that was so, I was like, oh, there are Christians who are 6-day historical, 24 literal hour like creationists who believe that happened. And a lot of people who are a lot smarter than me who actually hold to some of that. Then there was like others going, actually Genesis 1 is poetry and it's not trying to detail like modern history. And that was, in some ways, like I appreciated what you just started with, because it just was a load off and I'm like, it doesn't really matter that much. When I realized like it actually is teaching us who God is, in contrast to a lot of other creation stories that other religions wrote. And so I tend to be more on the analogical day, if you want to know what that means. Like I don't take the 24 hour days as literal 24 hours. But I do think that there's a lot of truth that it's teaching, and that I think poetry mm-hmm. It's clearly a psalm. It's clearly poetry in Genesis 1, but it's truthful.
It's so truthful. And what are the big takeaways? He did it. He loved it.
Yeah.
Right? Those are the most important takeaways. Mm-hmm. And we messed it up. There's that one in Genesis chapter 3, you know.
Yeah.
But and that he doesn't give up on us is the rest of the story, right?
Sure.
So I think those are the key points.
Yeah. There's one God, not many. He did it by speaking. So he's all powerful. he can do things because he's God. Like, and that's, I think, what it's communicating. We keep those there. Yeah. So.
My turn, your turn?
I don't know. I'm lost. A couple more. We can do a couple more. Okay. Is it because you can't read it? I can't read it either.
Well, if a parishioner. Son over here is good.
Okay, gracious. If a parishioner consistently dresses immodestly during church, this is a fashion one again. There we go. How do I speak the truth in love and raise concern? You ever had that happen?
Again, back to a staff member. I had to do this. I had this conversation with a member of my staff once that was having this issue. I mean, again, it was. If I remember the conversation, it's been a long, long time ago. Again, is what are we doing? And why are we doing it? And how does it make others feel? And why are we asking them? And what makes us interpret this as immodest versus another thing? And sort of finding those standards is a little bit subjective, but. Yeah, obviously it skews towards one gender over the other in terms of those conversations. I think we can all say that that's true. But yeah, I mean, I know I sound like a broken record, but I keep going back to that. Yeah. Why are we doing this? Who are we doing it? For whom are we doing it? And, you know, what is it saying? You know,
couple guiding things. I think doing it not in front of other people, obviously, to start. So doing it privately is important. Maybe asking questions about it, not assuming you know what's going on. Getting to know the person, all of those are probably wise things to do on the front end. But don't, if you're, what would you say
well,
about like?
I would
like,
just say timing is everything. In role, like this was a member of my staff who was in a leadership position in ministry with youth at the time. You know, like, so those are like important factors. I mean, I don't know. What was Mary Magdalene wearing the first time Jesus encountered and cast out the seven demons? I don't know. Like, there's timing of everything. You know, the woman of ill repute,
right.
Mary Magdalene, maybe that's Mary Magdalene, I don't know. But so timing is really important. And what is our, why are we asking it? When are we asking it?
Yeah.
And I think, again, truth and love.
Yeah.
It's one of those.
If it's the first time that you're meeting somebody, it's probably not the right time. I think there's probably... I'm curious if you would add anything. Do you think being a specific... So let's say hypothetically it is a woman who's dressed like this. Is it wise to not be a man to ask about? Or to have that conversation? Would you have a woman do that? Or do you think it's better to have a man do that?
I mean, I think, again, circumstances... Yeah. In this case, it was... I was the supervisor and I needed to be the one. Sometimes it is important to, you know, I think it's always important to ask the question, like, am I crazy? Am I wrong in asking this? I mean, it is, it's not easy. It's not, you know, straightforward, but.
All right. One more. Many relationships are based on proximity and not shared interest. How can those relationships be glorifying to God and fulfilling, I'm assuming, for oneself? I would disagree with the premise that many relationships are only based on proximity and not... I can't think of a... Like,
How about some of your family at the Thanksgiving table? I think there's that.
Okay.
I think that this is actually the real challenge. I mean, I think it's C.S. Lewis. If McGreevy was here, he would... clear me up on this point, but I think it's McGreevy. I mean, McGreevy.
They're often hard to figure out which one is Lewis and
right?
Which
one. But C.S. Lewis talked about like storge, which is this sort of familial love, is like the most supernatural. And I think it's actually one of the most beautiful things is those relationships that are based on proximity. So sometimes you're with your cousin and you're just like, there is no way I would be friends with this guy. But for the fact, he's my cousin, and I love him, and I'm with him, and I'm always going to love him. And so I think it's, in some ways, this sort of beautiful vision of the adoptive quality of the family that is the family of God, the household of God. And it's the, and sometimes it's in those proximity things that aren't based on shared interests that really test out this idea of love as family. If we're always just with the birds of a feather, always with those that share our interest, I don't know that that tests that at all.
Yeah.
And it can become very dangerous, you know, echo chambers or whatever, and surely makes Thanksgiving conversations a lot more boring. But I think, yeah, this is what God's called us to, is that, you know, if you look at the disciples, what a mixed bag that was.
Mm-hmm.
If you look at, I don't know, like a letter, 1 Corinthians or something like that, and you look at what he's rebuking is that tendency to separate into affinity groups. And he's saying no. And, you know, Galatians, what is it, 5 or whatever, you know, there's either slave or free, Jew or Greek, we're all one in Christ Jesus, male or female, but we're all one in Christ Jesus. I think that's, that would be my pushback.
I hadn't thought about family, but that's right. I was thinking probably workplace, but even there, you have, like, I think if you probe deep enough, you're going to, you can't just check out. And I think the family is a great illustration of, like, if I'm going to lean in because I'm related to this person, you can find some shared interest. So let's say, you know, maybe it's just the family that is the shared interest, that we believe this is something worth showing up for.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you're in the workplace and you're like, I'm with people who are decades outside of my age range and they have... different season, not the same interest, you actually work in the same place, and in some level, that is something that is worth, that's an interest that you have.
Mm-hmm.
Whether and so leaning into those and working hard, asking questions to actually like find what those are. But even if you can't find any, I think you're wise in saying just the effort itself glorifies God to love that when it's not reciprocated even. If you just continue to say, oh, I'll be here, I want to try to initiate that. So.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, let's throw it open to questions. Where's John? Is John good? Awesome. How are we doing on questions? We made it through like 7, so that was all right.
Well, we got 2 questions. So if you want to take a moment,
we can go through more.
We got more in this cookie jar if we run out, so that's fine.
Well, I can go ahead and ask this too. But if you want to ask a question, feel free to go ahead and post your question, or you can always upvote as well. I'll go ahead and ask the first one. How can I offer advice to my friend who is somewhat new to her faith on avoiding temptations she has fallen into without being controlling or condescending?
Yeah, that's good. You certainly don't want to be controlling, right? And so the essence behind controlling somebody is it's more about what you are wanting them to do. Well, love is I'm willing to risk myself for their good, and that good is defined by God. And so I think when you have the good that God says in mind, and you're looking to, instead of coming at somebody, coming alongside them is probably the way that I would picture what you're trying to do in that moment, which is, I want to come alongside, I want to learn, I don't assume that I know everything about this, but you can see something. And I think love is actually speaking the truth kindly and without bitterness, and trying to do that together. To not do that is unloving. So I think the posture of it is key. Anything you'd add to that?
I really encourage people to use questions that don't start with why. So telling people things without asking some questions, that's where you get into some of that sort of holier than thou, you know, thumping kind of thing. And likewise, asking why did you go to that whatever, you know, that defense mechanism, anytime the why question comes up, it just does something. So a lot of what's and how's and what are you hoping to, or where do you think this is going to lead, or I don't know. I mean, just trying to get at kind of how this person gets themselves into this situation, or kind of moving towards this thing that's tempting. Maybe finding out why is that tempting. Maybe you know. Maybe you even have experience.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, here's where this lands if you keep going down this path. So those would be some of the things I would suggest trying.
The times that I received this personally, when I was new in my own faith and had people who were actually willing to come alongside and recognize that I was pretty new as a Christian, I had kind of invited, like, I want to learn more, I recognize I don't, and so I kind of gave them permission to speak into my life. If you are in a relationship where somebody hasn't done that, I think there's still been folks that have kind of brought me under their wing without me really seeking it. And I really appreciated that in the long run. Where there have also been times where that's gone terribly wrong, and it was a lot of the, like, I'm gonna tell you what you don't know and this and that. And a lot of it is nonverbal communication and how that's coming across, I think.
Like, I think the other thing is to say, and forgive me for seeming patronizing right now as the old guy in the room, but I can remember my time horizon and approach to things. I was very urgent and thought it had to be done immediately, whereas now with some time and some experience, I've started to say, you know what, actually there's a pretty good long time horizon here. It would probably be better for me to befriend and continue to say, come follow me, or let's do this together, or, you know, and realize, like, if I don't get this person sorted right now, but kind of do the slow burn, that actually has the better shot at A, causing them to change their path, but B, for it to last and to not, to take, if you will. So, yeah.
That's good.
Look at Jesus also, like, how did he do this with his disciples? And how quick was he to forgive and welcome back in and, you know, keep working with them, even when they screwed up? Yeah. What's the other one?
What does it mean to commit the unforgivable sin?
We've actually answered this one fairly recently. And so the unforgivable, I think this was probably within a few months, I think Brian answered it, but so I can answer this pretty quickly. But it's basically the unforgivable sin that is mentioned in the Gospels about blaspheming the Holy Spirit. The only thing that is basically rejecting Jesus at the end of the day, where you are persisting in unbelief towards Jesus. That there isn't some like secret sin that Jesus doesn't forgive. When you want to actually be forgiven, when you come to him seeking forgiveness, every sin is forgivable. So there, the only thing is that at the end of the day, if you were going to persist, yeah, I think the way Brian said this was, quoting Lewis, of course, there are two kinds of people, either those that say to God, "Thy will be done," or those that God says, "All right, thy will be done." Mm-hmm. And I think that is a good way of looking at it. Ultimately, at the end of the day, God is willing to forgive any and everyone who comes to him and trusts him in faith. But for those who persist in rejecting him, he will say, "Thy will be done."
Mm-hmm. And even a step further, not just rejecting, but calling him evil, calling Jesus evil. And I would also say this, if you're asking that question, you're not committing.
Yeah, that's, yeah. That's right. That's right. Are there more we have, or?
Have new ones come in?
Yes, we have.
Hot off the presses, excellent.
All right.
All right. How do you gain clarity about where God is uniquely calling you during a season of life?
Ooh, that's a tough one.
I'm going to answer this in a sort of negative way that'll get to a positive way. So, here's how I know something I'm not called to in my experience is, and I'll give it a very practical example. So, all three of my children are adopted, and it was between our second and third child. And so, my two girls are from Russia, and my a couple of years after we adopted our second child, that Putin shut down adoptions in Russia. And so we thought, I kind of got ticked off at Putin and thought, the way I'm going to get back to him is I'm going to adopt another child. I'll show you, Putin.
Take that.
Maybe it does get back in somehow. But we thought, we must have to do a domestic adoption. And so we went through this process. And compared to an international adoption, especially in a place like Russia, a domestic adoption in the U.S. with a lawyer or whatever is like, it's like the difference between, you know, graduate level calculus and arithmetic. I mean, it is so much more straightforward and simple and less headaches and less visas and all kinds of stuff. And we just could not. We missed deadlines and we missed. And there was just this sort of failure to launch, this sort of like, just, I felt like I was pushing a barrel of bricks uphill at every, and my wife saying, and eventually I was just like, wait a minute, I don't think we're called to this. And I thought I had the whole thing wrong. And then later on, my wife got a Facebook post or whatever about a need in China for families that would be willing to adopt boys with medical needs. And she just was terrified that I thought we weren't supposed to do any of this. And she came to this, and immediately it was like fog cleared. And opportunities opened up, and we hit every mark, and we just boom, 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 boom. The next thing you know, we have Bo Dickinson, our son. So that's just a practical example of these sort of contrasts and something to which I don't feel called to something that I feel called. And this sense of like, if it feels like I am crowbarring, that's probably not something you're called to. And listen to that. And it may be terrifying to answer that. It may be incredibly disappointing. Like, I just knew I was meant to be on the PGA Tour until we talked about this.
Yeah.
And then it just became clear to me, like, no. And it's the death of a dream in some ways and stuff. But gosh almighty, it works out to really be this enormous load off and this incredible clarity of path when it comes up in micro and in macro situations. Anyway, that's just sort of an anecdotal answer to the question.
I think of, I don't know if this one was it about vocation in particular or just any sort of season?
Any season?
Yeah, so the things that come to my mind are usually vocation, like am I in the right vocation right now for this season? A relationship, right? That those are the two ones in my own life that I think back to. And going along with it, like, so being sensitive to how you feel in it is part of it, for sure. I found in my own life, I was so quick to just, because it felt bad, jump out of it. And one of the things I've had to learn to do is to stick through something. And so, like, a year at least, like, going back to what you talked about earlier, like, everything had to feel urgent in the moment, I think, when I was a little bit younger. And now it's like, well, actually giving something some time. And there can be seasons, you know. The exile for Israel probably did not feel great, but like that was what God had for them in that time. And so, but that's not necessarily something you should say, because if my life stinks right now, that's where God wants me. I don't think that's true. But just because it feels bad, I would say is true. It's a factor, but it's not, I wouldn't say it's the only factor. I would also begin to say why, I try to get underneath, okay, why is this so difficult for me? What exactly is the Lord trying to refine me in this particular season? And being open to, like, I think the biggest thing for me, honestly, was just the Lord, I began to believe that God has brought me every step of the way, that it wasn't an accident. It wasn't an accident that I showed up, you know, at Duke, even though I wasn't on the golf team all 4 years. And I was like, I hated it there. I hated it there for that first year.
I can imagine.
Yeah, as a demon deacon, why would you let... But then I ended up being discipled by a guy, and not even Durham. Like, I went to Raleigh, and that was a person that then...
Imagine,
like,
if you'd gone to Winston-Salem.
Who knows just how bad that would have been. But no, so... But the point was, is like... I think, yeah, like, yeah. College, relationships. There was one time where I was like, and I've said this before in this place, but I was convinced I was supposed to marry this other person, and was like intentionally trying to pursue this, and every time it just kept not going anywhere, and I was very concerned. And then right after that, the Lord put Molly right in my life. And so I think trusting in God's providence, that his hand is guiding you, especially when you're seeking his face, not just pushing the eject button when it's hard, but sticking it out for a season, asking other Christians about this too. So if you're in the field, again, exploring why is this so painful? Maybe it's a season of like, I was in college and I could do what I wanted for a very long time, but now I'm in a workplace and I work 9 to 5, and that can be just challenging and frustrating. But I think inviting others into that and seeking the Lord's face and trusting that even in those times where you're worried, I'm going to waste this, he doesn't waste it, I think, is the biggest thing.
Assuming it is within legal parameters, what are your thoughts on age gaps in relationships?
I love that first part. Great qualifier.
Yeah.
As the son of a man from West Virginia, I appreciate that. And my parents are only a year apart in age, just so we're clear.
So many things.
I don't know.
Have you ever had in your pastoral counseling anything like this come up?
You know, yes, it was my sister. It was a bad idea, the guy. But it wasn't because he was 13 years older than her, although I'm sure that contributed somewhat, but it was more than he was just awful. But they do exist. Awful people do exist. God has enough grace for them and mercy to save them. But, yeah, I mean, I don't know. I mean, again, when are we talking? I mean, stages of life, it makes a difference. Like, you know, when one person is 20 and the other is 10, that's really creepy and dangerous. That's legal, I guess.
That's not the legal.
Maybe,
yeah, that's the qualifier.
Even 30-20 feels weirder than 60-50. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, so I don't know. I think that's a squirrely question in some ways, but yeah, it depends on, and what is age? I mean, I've met some guys that are 50 that are way less mature than some women that are 25 or whatever.
Absolutely.
So I guess it just depends on the situation. I don't think there's a biblical, forbidding of that sort of thing. But
I do think you're pointing out seasons,
wisdom,
right?
So wisdom, I guess, seek wisdom. Does it feel like a wise choice in a sense?
As you get older, that age gap doesn't seem to be as significant, but I think that's a helpful qualifier. At the end of the day, age is a factor in who you are, because age is simply your experience and how you've engaged either wisely or unwisely with your experiences lived, right? And so you can be a 35-year-old and not have grown up at all and still be very selfish with a very mature 22-year-old. And those people are not, again, the principle behind, I think it's looking at equally yoked, right? Like you want to find somebody that's the same trajectory and same path, at least in their Christian faith, but also pretty similar in where you're hoping to go. Mm-hmm. And that can be, and maybe it was with your sister, but at the end, what I heard you say, I think that's important, was like the kind of person that he was mattered far more than the age.
Yes. And one thing is the age being used as a weapon?
Yeah.
Like, oh, you would say that. Poor, simple, youngin, you know, or whatever. There's a controlling factor in it or something like that. And that's dangerous, not good, but
yeah.
That answers the question.
But don't...
Not that was a bit of a bumbling answer, sorry.
Right. No, that's good. Don't break the law, though.
Please don't. 2010, don't do that. That was a bad example.
What to do when experiencing physical anxiety?
What's new?
What to do.
Okay.
Physical anxiety.
Physical anxiety.
Okay. Can I? Is that just mental anxiety that has physical manifestations? Is that what we're talking about? Anybody can say yes, that's what that means. I don't know the term exactly. Physical anxiety versus
mental. Yeah, I would think that's
anxiety.
Where my mind goes.
Okay,
but
so like having heart palpitations and...
Yeah,
like
physical manifestations, right, of the internal anxiety that you're experiencing.
Right. Yeah, I don't feel equipped to answer the question exactly. I've heard about like breathing exercises and things like that. And certainly praying and slowing down and seeking help and all of those sorts of things. I don't have a great answer.
I'm not. So the little bit that I have to offer, my wife has a lot of anxiety, and the things that she's like, it's literally just like tapping your feet like this or your hands in the moment of like a panic attack has helped a lot. A focus on breathing, like it has something to do with the way that you're thinking. So this big picture, anxiety has to do with the fact that we're human beings and we have bodies that are important. They're not like the material side of us is not less than the spiritual side. And so engaging in how the body is made and how it can help relieve some of that. But I think also we're also a soul as well. And there can be a spiritual side to everything that we do. And so I wouldn't want to dismiss engaging prayer as well. I wouldn't say any, but like most, even secular folks will talk about the benefit of like some sort of meditation or prayer is going to be helpful too. So those sort of things are good.
That's right. And I think, seeking the help of a professional who deals with these sorts of things on a regular basis is also helpful. But yeah, I mean, what we can offer is comfort and care and prayer and maybe some perspective and listening. And those are all helpful things to help bring down the temperature a little bit. But in a moment of panic or whatever, like that's where I'm a little bit out of my depth in these sorts of things. So I encourage you to seek professional help.
One more. Oh, goodness. Let's just do one more. Why not? It's past 8:30. We're almost done. Unless this is like a 15-minute answer. Sorry. Let's go for it.
All right.
Oh, God.
Do you all have any infant baptism book recommendations?
Yes.
Heck yes.
I do.
All right.
I can answer that.
How would you answer that?
I have two that I can recommend. One, Baptism by Michael Green, one of my tutors from Oxford. It's a great little book. It gives an Anglican understanding of it, but also puts it into perspective. He was like the Billy Graham of England, so he understands the Anabaptist and sort of Credo-Baptism argument as well as the paedo-baptism argument. And then there's another one that's just come out by Scott McKnight, I think it is. It Takes a Church to Baptize. We're giving that one out to our folks at our church, because we have a lot of folks that have sort of come to our church that come from other traditions, and that's kind of been a hang-up for them, trying to sort of, how do I, and, you know, we don't say it's a, you know, you can't be here if you don't buy this, because it's still, I think that's one of those ones that we'll get to glory and see what the answer is. But that's another book. I think it's Scott McKnight. Google that. It Takes a Church to Baptize. And those are two that cover this.
That's right. Yeah.
And McKnight was a Baptist who has become an Anglican. So anyway.
There's one that. So
you don't have to buy that. Like, let me just say this. Obviously, we as Anglicans believe in infant baptism, and we do that. But as I say, I went to Wake Forest, so I have a lot of Baptist friends, and it's not a salvation issue and a covenant and communion breaking issue for me. So you don't have to buy it in terms of what it's selling. You don't have to buy it necessarily to be counted Christian, but at least we'll give you a good understanding of where we come from, at least a lot of the arguments that we have for why we do this practice.
I'm glad you said that. I grew up in the Anglican Church. I went to a Baptist church in college, actually, and then went to a Presbyterian seminary, so I've been kind of all over. The thing that I was going to say, actually, was reading John Calvin, which that was the biggest thing for me. It was like, being in the Baptist church, people were like, this is taking the Bible seriously was my experience, and I was like, oh, wow, I want to take the Bible seriously. It's good. But then I realized, like, the church throughout the centuries had held this for biblical reasons. And that, so reading Calvin's book 3 in the Institutes was actually kind of helpful. Book 4, sorry, was really helpful. But if you're not of that persuasion, I will say there's a much more modern book that doesn't even mention infant baptism, but I think it's actually critically important for understanding infant baptism, because it's about sacraments. It's called Truth We Can Touch. Have you come across this?
No.
Tim Chester, it's a little, you know, little book. Tim Chester's Mims here. She knows. I was like, order like a billion of these Mims. And so we give them out for our infant baptism stuff, and maybe they read it, maybe they don't. But it's saying, you know, let's put the mode of baptism aside. Let's talk about what baptism symbolizes actually is. And the way he does it, and he traces, like, yes, the whole story, like, the people of God in the Old Testament being involved in the community that they were always, I think for me, realizing Old and New Testament was always about being saved through faith. It wasn't works in the Old, but faith in the New, and that they were included. And also debunking the Roman Catholic understanding that, like, baptism is a guarantee to change you, regenerate you, and all that, save you. Because of what the priest has done, like, that's not. So it was debunking some of that personally, but the Truth We Can Touch is a good book that helps you understand baptism and communion without getting into the nitty-gritty on, like, the disagreements. It's a Christian book, and because we're not going to split over, I think. You know, these are brothers and sisters in Christ. So that was too much. But
thanks for that. I'll read that book now. Thanks.
Pete, thanks for coming. Y'all, thanks for coming out. We're going to be here. Thanks.